The Public Safety Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. Thank you, members. It is 10:05. I usually try to start on time. I think what I'd like to do first is just, I don't know everybody here, and some of you are new to the legislature, and I know you've been through this process and every other committee, but it is helpful for me and probably helpful to all of us as we work together on these issues to know a little bit about each other. So I think I'll start with the staff, and then we'll ask the members to introduce themselves. So why don't we start with the staff and just tell us who you are and where you come from and what your role is here for this committee. So I'll start with our new committee administrator.
My name is Laura Taken-Holtze. I am the committee administrator for the Public Safety Finance and Policy Committee.
You want to tell us what you used to do?
I used to clerk for Judge Kevin Burke. I was there for quite a few years. And before that, I was in law school.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. DJ Danielson, I'll be your committee legislative assistant. I believe my fourth non-consecutive session working here in some capacity or another. Need anything, please feel free to contact me. I'm also Representative Paymar's legislative assistant, too. So thank you.
Kate.
My name is Kate Weeks. I'm with the Hill Caucus Republican. This is my seventh session.
Okay, other staff.
Good morning. John Holtquist, House GOP Research. After 20 years in the governor's office, I spent the last 2 years as the committee administrator for this committee.
Hi, Becky Perius. I'm with the Nonpartisan House Research Department. This is my eighth session, staffing public safety and judiciary.
My name's Jeff Diebel. I'm also in House Research. This is my 12th session, and I'm also an officer in the Army Reserve JAG Corps, so I do public safety-related work for the Army.
Mr. Chair, my name is John Walls. I'm a fiscal analyst. This is my 19th session, but second with this committee.
Hey, welcome. And Paige's. Great. Anyone else?
I'm Chloe Brown. I'm PhD 2, and I'm from Miami.
You're from where?
Miami.
Jeez, the weather must feel like you're right at home. Okay, any other staff that I'm missing? I think we're really blessed at the legislature having, the kind of staff that we do, and especially in our nonpartisan staff that have been here for a long time. I just rely on them so much, and you should too. They know a lot. So maybe we could have the members introduce themselves and just tell us a little bit about how long you've been here and what district you represent. And I'm curious to know if you do anything public policy in your other life when you're not a legislator, or why you chose to be on this committee. Maybe you were not chose. Maybe you didn't choose, but you're here anyway. So I'll just say a little bit about myself. I haven't been on this committee for a couple of years, so that's why I don't know everybody here. But I was the chair of this committee for 4 years, and when I'm not a state legislator, I have been for the last, I'm making myself old here, about 25, 30 years. I do a lot of work in the domestic violence prevention and intervention field, training law enforcement and criminal justice professionals on how to deal with domestic violence cases, and I've done a lot of work with male offenders. So that's sort of my background and passion, I guess. So, and I didn't do a seating assignment. I don't know if that's okay. So why don't we start over here? And
thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Andrea Kiefer from Woodbury area, and this will be my second term serving on the Public Safety Committee.
Thank you. Welcome.
I'm Linda Slocum, and I represent west and central Richfield and east and central Bloomington, so pieces of both cities. And this is my second time on public safety. I'm a school teacher by trade. Oh, my fourth term.
I'm Joe Mullery, representative from North Minneapolis. I've been on this committee a lot of different terms, chaired the policy part of it for a while. Obviously, with my district, I'm quite interested in public safety, but in real life, an attorney, not handling criminal law.
Welcome back, Joe.
Brian Johnson, Cambridge, Minnesota, represent two-thirds of Isani County and the northern third of Chisago County. This is my first term in the legislature. I'm proud to be on this committee. As just retired as over 27 years in law enforcement.
Welcome.
I'm Mark Uglum, represent 36A, which is Champlin and part of Coon Rapids. First time on this committee, first term a legislator. Have been the mayor of Champlin for three previous terms.
Very good. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Kathy Lomer, and I am from District 39B, which is the East Metro along the St. Croix River from St. Mary's Point all the way up through Stillwater, Lake Elmo, Grant. I have 13 communities that I represent. This is my second term and my first time on public safety, and I'm really excited to be on this committee. Like I was sharing with you earlier, I have two major prisons in my district, and also realize that the Tubman Center falls under this committee, and I'm very interested in that organization. So thank you.
Welcome.
I'm Tony Cornish from Good Thunder, Minnesota, and District 23B, representing parts of Waseca and Blue Earth and Watonwan County. And my passion is public safety. It always has been, and I'm 36-year retired cop. So,
welcome.
I'm State Representative Deborah Hillstrom. I represent all of the City of Brooklyn Center and parts of Brooklyn Park. It's District 40B. I have served in the legislature for, this is my 13th year. I, too, previously chaired the Public Safety Policy Committee. In my day job, I'm a prosecutor, and I prosecute cases everywhere from misdemeanor DNR violations to I have a property felony caseload as well, and I've been doing that for about 3 years.
Welcome.
I'm Dan Schoen from 54A, which is Newport, St. Paul Park, South St. Paul, Cottage Grove. First term, my day job is a police officer and paramedic down in Cottage Grove, and I've got a background in narcotics and violent crimes for 4.5 years, hazmat background as well, bunch of different various assignments in my role as a police officer, so I'm pretty excited about this, and thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Eric Simonson. I'm from the western half of Duluth, District 7B, and my first term, and my day job is I work for the City of Duluth Fire Department, been there about 23 years now, and currently serve as Assistant Fire Chief.
Thank you. Welcome.
I'm John Ward, and I want to be in Miami. State Representative from District 10A, which is Crow Wing County up in Brainerd, Pequot Lakes, Nisswa area. I'm in my fourth term. I have served on this committee once before, so this is my second term on this committee. And I'm a former retired teacher, but beyond education, I think public safety is a huge priority for the state of Minnesota, and I also am thrilled to be on this committee.
Thank you. Welcome.
My name is Shannon Savick, and I have a representative from 27A. This is my first term. I'm the former mayor of Wells, Minnesota, and the reason I wanted to be on this committee is because as the mayor, I was the mayor when we had the LGA cuts and I saw how they negatively affected the public safety of the small rural communities.
Welcome. I'm not sure where that is. I should know more.
Well, it's down, it's in Faribault County.
Oh, it's in Faribault County. Okay.
Yeah.
By Blue Earth.
About okay. Between Blue Earth and Albert Lea.
Got it now. Thank you. Welcome.
It's good to be back. I was on this committee before. Steve Simon. I represent St. Louis Park and Hopkins, which is already also where I'm from, southwest Minneapolis suburbs. fifth term, I think third time on the committee, and in my other life, I'm a lawyer.
Welcome.
John Lesh. I served on this committee ever since I was elected. This is my 11th year, but I didn't serve on it last term because it conflicted with taxes. So likewise, I'm happy to be back. I am a prosecutor in my other life. I've been a prosecutor for the city of St. Paul for 11 years. But my interest on this committee is primarily because of the discretions committed in my intemperate youth.
Well, we welcome you anyway. Okay, well, that was helpful to me. I apologize in advance if I don't remember you immediately when you're wanting to speak on something, but I'll, like I said, I used to have have assigned seating, but I'll just let people, hope people won't sit. This is a real nonpartisan committee, I've always thought, so I hope people will mix it up a little bit. So, anyway, I just wanted to wanted to make sure that you've had an opportunity to look over the committee rules and ask you if you have any questions about them, concerns about them. They're not a whole lot different than you've probably seen in other committees. Questions? Well, you can look them over. If anything comes up before we adjourn for the day, you can bring them to my attention. Otherwise, I'll assume that there's no problems with them. I don't really think there's anything that unusual about them. I just ask, I guess I have one issue, like I do have an issue about cell phones, and if you are going to use your tablets, I'd ask that you use them only to look up statutes. And I know that we're busy and do a lot of multitasking around here, but I just in fairness and respect to the public and to the staff that comes to testify here, I really hope that we not use those that kind of communication during committee. I just wanted to say, just to start off, we have an overview from the Department of Corrections, but I've always seen this committee as being nonpartisan, I know that you share my view that public safety is a core function of the state of Minnesota. Having said that, I bet every other chair in the legislature would say that the work that they're doing, whether it's in education or transportation or the environment, are all core public issues that are important to the state of Minnesota. But it's clear that our public has to be safe, and we need to provide the necessary resources to ensure that. And I've always thought that we should be tough on crime, but we should also be smart when we're fighting crime. And that's sort of been my mantra. We've had testimony, and you'll hear testimony, that 95% of the offenders that we put in our correctional facilities are all coming out. And they're coming out to my neighborhood and your neighborhood at some time or another. So maybe more in your neighborhood. So... and that is an issue that but they're coming out, and so I hope that when we think about being smart on crime, that we really sort of push the envelope a little bit and think about ways that we can stop people from going in there in the first place. And that means prevention, that means intervention, that means ensuring that those offenders who do get released are not part of that revolving door and going back into the system. So that's sort of my philosophy on things. I've had a good conversation with the lead Republican on this committee, Tony Cornish, and I think we're on the same page on what we'd like to accomplish this year. We don't know what our budget number will be, but I've always fought for a high number because I think we need it, and so we'll just have to see what happens. We're not going to really delve into the budget until after the governor releases his budget document on the 22nd. I'm planning on having an omnibus public safety finance bill. I haven't had an opportunity yet to confer with Representative Hillstrom about how we're going to do all of this, because these committees used to be, they've sort of merged and not merged, and so we'll have to figure out how we're going to do this and what bills that Representative Hillstrom needs to hear. I have had a tendency to hear most bills, so if you have a bill that wants to be heard, please get it in. We'll deal with it. I also told Representative Cornish, and if any of you are interested, there's a lot of work that this committee does. If you're interested in us creating a subcommittee for something that you want to work on that's specific to, I know some of you have a lot more public safety experience than others, but if there's something that you want to deal with, we can create a subcommittee and make that effective, and I just think it would be a better use of our time. So if you're interested in that, let me know. We did that in the past where minority members have chaired subcommittees, and I think it's a real smart idea. I'd like us to work together as best as we possibly can. So I also wanted to ask you, you don't have to, maybe a little bit, just to get a sense of tours. This committee has taken tours before. Are you interested in doing that? I know it's difficult to get away, but Fridays might be the only days that work to take tours. And I know some folks from Greater Minnesota don't always want to do that, but are people interested in tours? I know some of you have been to prisons. Not everybody has, but it's important for you to see what's going on out there. So we could do a tour of the BCA, which is one of our accounts. That's in St. Paul, so it wouldn't take us too long, but that's an interesting tour if you've never done it. Or we could go to Stillwater and see Oak Park Heights. That's informative. Or tours? Interested? Anyone?
You sure?
Representative Ward?
Mr. Chair, let me just ask this question. Some of us drive by corrections facilities on our way to and from, those of us in Greater Minnesota. I drive right by the St. Cloud prison. I think it's still called prison. Would it be possible for individuals through the purview of the committee to have individual tours, or set up a tour based on going to or from the Capitol, no matter where you are?
I'm getting heads nodding from the Department of Corrections, so I think that's fairly easy to do.
No, this way.
So if you'd like an individual tour, sometimes that's a better way to do it, actually, if you have the time to do it. So we'll make that available. But we can also get the prison bus and take a tour together. So anyway, the committee administrator will sort of do some polling, and we'll see if what kind of time is available. Representative Slocum, did you have...
Well, Mr. Chair, the individual tour sounds kind of intriguing because I talk a lot. But I would love to tour the Shakopee Women's Facility.
We can make that happen, too. So, okay, well, we'll put out some options, and you can check the box, and we'll just see if we can make it happen. I know some of you have done this before. Just in terms of the schedule... We're planning on doing things a little bit differently until the budget comes out. Tomorrow, we're going to have a presentation from the Department of Public Safety. So these are just overviews. We're not getting into the budget now. And then Tuesday, we hope to have a presentation on the three probation systems that we have in the state of Minnesota. We have a complicated system here that people have tried to change for years, and maybe it should be, maybe it shouldn't be, but we'll try to scratch the surface of that, and also look at some of the Department of Corrections. I'm hoping we're able to do this reentry programs on Tuesday. Wednesday, we will be having a presentation on sexual violence in the state of Minnesota. We've asked MnCASA, if you haven't seen their presentation before, I haven't actually seen it, but they're going to make a presentation on the cost of sexual violence in the state, which I think is about $8 billion or something. It's some enormous figure when it... So we're going to do this... Hang on one second. We're going to have this presentation from MnCASA. Dean Janis from William Mitchell will be here and talking about... sort of prevention and what we're doing with sex offenders. I'm not sure how much we want to delve into the task force's recommendations at this point, but one of the reasons why I wanted to do this was whatever recommendations come forward, that's not necessarily our committee, because the MSOP program comes under the Department of Health and Human Services. But if there's any significant changes, it's going to have an impact on the Department of Corrections, especially if we have indeterminate sentencing or want to augment the sex offender treatment in the Department of Correction facility. So I thought it would be good to have that kind of overview on Wednesday. Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to ask if the MnCASA one was the same as presented last year. I think both at the Capitol and over at the Kelly Inn. And my second point was I hope you do explore also the reentry of the MSOP because that affects us directly.
You mean, do you want to say more about that, the reentry of MSOP?
Well, what they decide to do with the sex offenders.
When they are going to be released, you mean?
Yeah, because if they get shifted back and wherever they go, they're going to be out, and it's important to the kind of treatment and different things in the reentry programs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. And then Thursday, we're going to look at somewhat of domestic violence, trying to look at some of the innovative things that are going on here also, like what we can do to combat trafficking. You've probably heard about the legislation that created the Safe Harbor Project and the desire to expand that and how we're dealing with some of the prevention and advocacy side of it. So that's sort of our schedule until and then the following week we'll take up the budget. I do want to say that we will be getting into some very controversial issue either at the end of the month or the first week of February, and that is the issue of gun control. And it's in light of the shootings that have happened around the country, and especially this massacre that happened in Connecticut and what happened in Minneapolis, I think it's appropriate that we address this issue. So my plan is to take one whole committee day and probably recess and have the committee reconvene into the evening for public testimony, but to hear any and all gun bills on one or two committee days in early February. I have a bill on universal background checks. I know there are many other bills that are have been drafted. I've told Representative Cornish that we will hear his bill that is drafted. I don't know if it's been put in yet, but and so any gun bills that you have percolating in your head, you should get them drafted. I'd rather hear them all on in one day. Given that it's volatile and contentious, I'm expecting that there'll be a lot of organizations that will want to testify, and a lot of members of the public that will want to testify on any of those bills, that's why I want to make the evening meeting available so we can have a real full dialogue and not cut people off. And let me say that when we have that meeting, it won't specifically be on gun control. I'd like us to broaden that whole discussion, so I'm hoping that we can get people from NAMI here to talk about mental health problems. educators to talk about security in our schools, community groups that and neighborhoods that are affected by gun violence, you know, in Minneapolis and St. Paul, law enforcement, and have a wide range of discussion on this issue. What I haven't decided on yet is whether we will vote on all those bills at that time, or if they will be laid over into some kind of an omnibus bill or omnibus public safety policy bill. Representative Mullery.
Oh, Representative, or Mr. Chairman, I had heard your initial, which was talking about mass murders, and I was concerned that what the police chief of Milwaukee called slow-motion mass murders in the inner cities was also, I just want to make sure, but then you, at the end of your talk, you mentioned basically that that's going to be on the table, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Any questions about that? Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how late do you anticipate then that we would go? Are you going to have a cutoff time, or just however long it takes, we're going to do them all? Or I'm just trying to get a sense if we're coming in and then we're going to stay into the evening, how late we should plan to be here. Do you know?
Representative Hillstrom, I don't know at this point. I have a feeling it would be late, but I don't want to keep us here that late. If we need to go over into the next committee day, I think I'd rather have the latitude to do that and really have I don't like cutting people off after a minute of testimony, so I'd rather do it respectfully given how contentious and emotional this issue is.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Okay, with that, if there's anything else, okay then. So, Commissioner, welcome to the committee. Members, I've asked the commissioner on short notice. I didn't realize I appreciate you coming on short notice because I you didn't have to be here. You could have had your assistants do this, but I appreciate that you were willing to come back early from, I know you were at some meetings out of town. But this is more of an overview, so, you know, if you could hold your budget questions, and I know that if you could hold your budget questions, that would be helpful until we actually know what the governor's budget is. And so, Commissioner, with that, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, it is indeed a pleasure to be back in this room, especially the first meeting. And too often, the Department of Corrections is brought in around specific cases or issues, and to appear before you today and give you an overview of the good work that we do is indeed a privilege. Just in terms of my background, I am just starting my 39th year in the field of corrections. I'm driven by a mission, as well as our department is driven by a mission, and that is to reduce future crime. All of our activities, all of our conversations are around that goal. And as you can see in the first page of our presentation here, our mission statement is to reduce recidivism by promoting offender change through proven strategies during safe and secure incarceration and effective community supervision. When I did this presentation 2 years ago, I was a rookie commissioner. I think I have a better understanding of what services we are providing in the Department of Corrections. I'm glad to see familiar faces around this table. I'm also glad to see some people around this table that have contributed to public safety in terms of their work. And I think I will echo the comments of the chair that public safety is nonpartisan. I've said that so many times during the past 2 years. I think it rises quickly to the top of citizen lists in terms of what they expect of government, and public safety is certainly, the surveys I've seen, in the top three always. And sometimes it's been absent from the public dialogue. I know, I would guess, that very few of you ran on criminal justice platforms, reforms as part of your campaigns. It has been significantly absent from the national dialogue, and unfortunately, the national dialogue has increased because of tragedies. As I look around this table, I know the police officers know that these tragedies happen every day. from the Department of Corrections. We know that these tragedies happen to many of the offenders and involve many of the offenders that we release. So we are quickly observant of the weight of our duties and the importance of the work we do. Our presentation today will involve some very important people behind me and our senior staff in charge of our institutions, in charge of our probation and parole, and some of our internal operations. They will be part of this presentation, and it's really a privilege to present with them today because over the past 2 years I've really discovered how good they are at what they do and the extent of their experience as well. I'm going to draw your attention immediately to this first slide. And it, when I presented 2 years ago, the picture of the prison was absent of any human beings. And one of our main emphasis, what we want to emphasize with our department, is that corrections is just not buildings and prisons and prison doors, and it involves the transformation of offenders through human involvement. Our presentation today is not going to be all comprehensive. I hope it's going to be an introduction to the work we do, to talk about some of our initiatives. And I think it will develop some questions for you, and we are fully prepared to answer some of those questions today. But as Mr. Chair indicated, our presentations into the future will be far more detailed. And I sense that in this room there is a strong interest in our department, and it's greatly appreciated. I also need to set the plate in terms of context where we see our Department of Corrections and the criminal justice system. I'm going to use a sports metaphor, and I think people will get it. I hope they do. We have robust police forces in most of our communities, well-trained, well-educated, professional police officers doing great work. We have professional prosecution, defense. We have a judiciary that's extremely talented and with a significant workload. Lots of public effort, lots of public dollars devoted to all of that infrastructure. We see our corrections department as kind of the red zone of the criminal justice system. All that work gets us into the red zone. We get handed off the offender, and it's now our responsibility to do work with that offender to make sure that he doesn't come back. It's a tough message. There's not a great constituency out there that says spend money on offenders, spend money on offender housing, spend money on people that supervise offenders. It's just not a popular notion, and we accept that. So it's super important for us that when we get in that red zone, when that offender is given to us, we have to use proven strategies that are efficient, that meet the public's needs, and especially meet the needs of victims, which are so important because they really feel the pain and the seriousness of the work we do. We've embedded some video clips in here to give you a sense of...
Commissioner, before you do the clips, can I? We have a question right now, so I'll just if people have questions, is that okay if we interrupt your presentation?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. If there are easy questions, we always appreciate.
Well, we'll see. Representative Lash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Roy, your mission is reduce recidivism by promoting offender change. Do you view your mission in any way as that of punishment?
Certainly incapacitation, Mr. Chair, Representative. Incapacitation is an important part of our mission, primarily because the people that are walking in our doors are not capable of living amongst us in their current state. Some may not be capable or successful when we release them, but it's that incapacitation either through probation or in our facilities, and then the treatment that we provide we see most important, and our research department, who will be presenting here, will give you some indication of how successful we are in that regard.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could, I think it's just, I had that question because from time to time we see bills coming forward that are oftentimes driven by citizens' frustration with the situation and their expectation of some measure of punishment, on top of which they really appreciate recidivism, and it's our job as policymakers to ensure recidivism. But I just want to make sure that that's not lost, that it is somewhat a piece of it, depending on the victim or depending on the family or depending on the person. I don't want it to get lost in the mission. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair,
please proceed.
We have talked about our mission, and we referenced the Constitution of our fine state, where protection really is essential to the work we do. For those members who have not served on this committee before, a very brief overview of our prison system. We are very staff intensive. Obviously, when we run facilities 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, we have three shifts basically. We are very heavily staffed because it takes people to feed, it takes people to guard. We have eight adult prisons, and some of those prisons were referenced already this morning. The location obviously is around our heavy metro urban areas. We will hopefully in the future be able to offer more detail on our prison facilities and the work they do and the types of offenders that enter each of these facilities. And again, today it's just basically an overview. I will immediately address, however, our ability to tour, because that does sound like an interest. In the past 2 years, we have done numerous tours with medical folks, citizens, legislators, and I think it is so important as citizens and policymakers that you see the work that we do, because it is done in our name. When we take freedom from people, it's just second to taking their life. And if we don't recognize that serious burden as citizens, then we really don't get this whole show here. And we will accommodate group tours. If you have staffers who have never been in a prison before, if you have citizen members, people important in your communities, we will accommodate you, and we're very proud of doing that. We have an open-door policy. I assured the chair that we are going to be as transparent as we can in our presentations and in our statistics, and to get the feel for the good work we do, I think, is really important. We have two juvenile facilities, Red Wing and our Togo facility. We have wardens in charge of those facilities. We're very proud that we've been able to promote our female wardens in our department. We recognize that the important work that women do in all of our facilities. We are, and we'll talk more about population, but these are the base numbers that we're working with today, and I'll talk momentarily about where we stand with those numbers. We are, again, a large department, very employee-oriented. We have a tremendous number of offenders come in the doors, and we have a tremendous number that leave us every year. And that sheer processing of humans is a major activity. We assess people coming in for chemical dependency, mental health, medical conditions. We have buses that were mentioned. It's just the transfer of human bodies between facilities, county jails, is significant. A tremendous number of square feet devoted to this effort. I have heard this statistic. I have not verified this statistic, however, that we are second biggest in square footage next to the University of Minnesota. We serve about 30,000 meals a day. With that comes a significant cost. We have dietary concerns. We have standards that have to be met. We have staffing ratios that have to be met, and we will get into those greater details in the future. I also, and
I'm glad to hear, Mr. Chair, that you're going to be looking at the three delivery systems in Minnesota, so we'll get into more detail in the future on that. But Department of Corrections not only runs prisons, but we also have 20,000 offenders that our probation officers around the state supervise, part of about 130,000 total. Our community corrections partners and our county partners have a significant number as well. And we're spread all around the state. Other states, especially states in our southern tier, Texas, California, Arizona, Florida, Mississippi, are all struggling with rising prison populations. They rely heavily on prison response to crime. In Minnesota, we are very fortunate that work done 30 plus years ago and it's been two major policy initiatives that were accomplished. And I would guess some of the discussion happened in this very room, and that was the formation of sentencing guidelines, which became statute in 1981, and the formation of the Community Corrections Act, late 70s. There was work over 2 or 3 years, and we will go into great detail, but just briefly, sentencing guidelines has taken many of the variables out of sentencing practice. When I started as a probation officer making recommendations to the court for sentences, for felony sentences, there was a large variation in sentences based on location, geographic differences, philosophical differences. Felony sentences were often 0 to 3, 0 to 10. When a prisoner entered our prisons, they really didn't know when they were going to get out. Sentencing guidelines has become a discipline that has brought judges into conformity around certain offenses, all felony offenses, and it has made sentencing more predictable, prison populations predictable, costs predictable, and it was the Minnesota initiative around sentencing guidelines was a national model. Those states that don't have sentencing guidelines are experiencing tremendous problems with prison populations and disparity in sentencing racially and in numbers. So we are very fortunate to be in that state that we are. The Community Corrections Act, without great detail, allowed counties to come together or large counties to stand alone and become Community Corrections Act agencies with state contributions for more probation services, community treatment, with the recognition that low-level offenders are best handled in their own communities, receiving treatment in their own communities. Sending them away to prison is not a medical model. You don't just send somebody away to prison and expect them to come back better. And the Community Corrections Act recognizes that by increasing community services for offenders. As a result of those two initiatives, we're in a very lucky situation to be the 49th lowest incarceration rate for people in prison. And even if you add county jails and community treatment centers, we are still very, very low. So we're in really good shape, and it's a joy to be working in this environment. I shouldn't emphasize that word joy too much. There are some days that are less joyous than others. This is probably, if you don't remember anything else from this presentation, this slide really tells the story of Minnesota. The five states above us, the blue line, are the next in population greater than us, and the five below are the five lower in population. And immediately you can look at the prison population numbers, and this tells the tale. Only Maine has fewer people in prison. It is, and later slides will show us our trend here, but the two policy initiatives that I just discussed with you, Sentencing Guidelines and Community Corrections Act, really are driving us to this good statistic.
Commissioner, if you could hold for a minute and cover a couple questions from members. Representative Ward and Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Roy, one of the things I forgot to say earlier when introducing ourselves is I taught for 34 years, but my first 6 years was in a medium security prison up north in Saginaw called NERC, Northeast Regional Correction Center, represent Paymar, and then as an educator up there, in the medium security facility, then I moved on to community corrections as a director of a program called Project Care, and through that whole process of being involved in the corrections system as a staffer, I saw a huge positive change and long-term change in a number of offenders, through incentives. It kind of goes to Representative Lesh's question, too, through offenders, through the Project Care, or through the system that we had set up at NERC. I got an email from one of my constituents that says, in prisons, why don't we offer more honor housing, or why don't we take the offenders that are really changing their lives and becoming more productive members of society and put them into honor housing, or put them into a system similar like that to relieve some of the financial stress and population stress in those. Could you just address that maybe quickly?
Commissioner?
Chair, Representative Ward, I'm thinking we go back a long time, don't we? I started, yes, you do look familiar. Yes. I'm glad we're both have been released from that system. We intend to make a major presentation on housing and the importance of transitional housing for offenders and the challenges that released offenders face, and actually today we will touch on that. We recognize reentry, reintegration is a major initiative for us, and Deputy Solhide shortly here will get into that in more detail.
Thank you.
Nice to see you again, by the way.
Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ironically, we're missing the second chance day on the Hill right now, which is a great program. But anyway, I just wonder, I'm looking at your sources for the numbers, and it's kind of old, 2006. Are we at the same number? Is there any change?
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner, I'm sorry.
I asked that same question this morning when we reviewed this, and I've been assured by my staff that these are the best statistics, sometimes census statistics, but our status is exactly the same amongst those states.
Yes? Yeah. Proceed.
So to get something very tangible here, our neighbors to the east, this goes into greater detail. And again, it goes into a little more detail, very state specific. And as legislators very interested in budget, I think you are immediately drawn to the fourth line down. When you have a lot of prisons, when you have a prison strategy, your budget goes up immediately. So for a state that is very similar demographically, I think we are performing very well and very efficiently. I usually get a few questions from this slide.
Do you want to elaborate on this a little bit further, and then we'll...
The question really is why Wisconsin with such a different philosophy, and that is because of the traditional thinking around corrections and prisons. And many, many states, when you get a felony conviction, there are not local workhouses, there are not local programs. You don't have the Community Corrections Act, so prisons develop, prisons are built. And sometimes that history just continues, and it continues long. And Wisconsin now finds itself in a very tenuous situation in supporting this type of budget. In fact, we have had inquiries from Wisconsin in a number of areas about sentencing guidelines, community correction strategies, because this, and many states are experiencing this unsustainable corrections budget exceeding public education in some states. And that would be the last thing we want to do.
So your slide has gotten some questions now. So Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is just about this slide in particular, I guess. But And I just want to make sure I wrap my head around it, because there's such a significant difference here between Wisconsin and Minnesota. But I'm assuming when we're looking at these numbers that we're comparing state facilities to state facilities.
Commissioner?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
And follow up, if I may, can you give me a sense of the comparison between Wisconsin and Minnesota with, say, total population incarcerated? Maybe if we include federal facilities as well. I'm just trying to figure out why there's such a difference here.
Commissioner?
Representative, the federal inclusion and the inclusion of state community corrections facilities involves detail that I can't tell you today, but we will certainly get you that statistic. We are separate and distinct, of course, from the federal system, and it is but a very appropriate question. It gets back to our community corrections issue.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Roy, I see that total number of individuals under jurisdiction Department of Corrections in Wisconsin is around 90,000, with a population of 5.7 million total. In Minnesota, with a lower population of 5.3 million, the total number under the jurisdiction is a lot higher than that, being about 125,000. Does that number on adult probation and parole release include just those offenders who are supervised by corrections employees? Or does it include individuals who are supervised by community corrections?
Community corrections, Commissioner. Chair. Community corrections is included in that supervision number for Minnesota.
Okay.
So our community corrections partners are very important to us.
Mr. Chair?
Absolutely.
Commissioner Roy, then obviously it's a lot cheaper to supervise someone on probation than it is to incarcerate them, and Minnesota is doing an outstanding job at that. We don't have a sense, though, of how much cheaper, since the only numbers you have there are the corrections budget. And I'd be curious, because I think it'd be worthwhile, especially for those folks who support the philosophy and the effort and the direction, to establish how much cheaper it is. And I understand there are varying levels for one community corrections officer to handle how many different people. I'd just be interested in those numbers.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the presentation next Tuesday on three delivery systems, we'll get into that level of detail, comparative costs and numbers.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. As a follow-up, Commissioner, don't you actually request the budget amount as part of what your budget request is for these community corrections as well?
Commissioner Roy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, the Community Corrections Act funds are passed through our department, but they certainly have important input into that discussion, if I'm getting your question.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make sure that it is part of your budget, that presentation, that you'll be asking for the money for those community corrections.
Yeah. Thank you.
Please proceed.
These are the base numbers, and I'm taking note of the time here, and I think they will speak from themselves. We have probation cases, and we have parole cases in Minnesota, and I think it's important just in terms of terminology. Minnesota parolees are called supervised releasees. I like to use the word parole because everybody knows what it means. It's release from prison after doing two-thirds of their time. And again, we will be going into more detail on these numbers. Convicted felons, obviously going into prison, sentenced to a minimum of a year and a day. And the statistic that Mr. Chair talked about previously, that 95% of our offenders end up back in our neighborhoods and communities, and that tells us that we better do a good job with them while we have them. And as a result of sentencing guidelines, we have a strong emphasis on person offenders. People that hurt other people are ranked very high in the sentencing guideline structure. So those people almost immediately go to prison. We have serious drug offenders, property offenders that have had numerous other crimes, and weapon offenses. Felons in possession of firearms is a very common one returning to prison.
Commissioner, at some point when you come back and your assistant commissioners testify before the committee, I would like to, if you could spend a little, not today, but a little more time on who's actually incarcerated on drug offenses. You know, I always hear from the department these are the, quote, serious offenders. And again, I don't need it today, but are these like are these individuals who have committed multiple crimes in addition to their drug sale offenses, and how many offenders are in there for maybe multiple charges of possession, and sort of break that out so we can get a sense of the whole drug issue and how that's impacting the Department of Corrections.
Mr. Chair, we'd be glad to do that, but I will immediately reference the draft or the report to the legislature prepared by the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and I don't know if that's been released yet, but this committee probably will hear a report on that. It goes into great detail about not only the types of offenses and their length of sentence, their departures from sentence, and it's, I would encourage everybody on this committee to read that report, and I learn something from it every time I read it. Excellent report, and Kelly Mitchell and her group do excellent work. I'm now going to turn this presentation over to Dr. Grant Dewey, who is our research director and nationally recognized.
One second, Commissioner, we have one more question. Okay. Representative Schoen.
I just wanted to, Commissioner, or Mr. Chair, Commissioner, what I wanted to ask about is on some of those drug offenses as well, if you get down to it, are you able to determine if they pled to the drug charge on top of multiple other felonies, and that was what they were sentenced on in a plea agreement? When we ask about those particular, is it that specific crime?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the subject matter of the last two Sentencing Guidelines Commission meetings was in large part directed to that issue, plea negotiations, departures, what was the original crime, what was pled down, and again, that report will detail a lot of that, and we can certainly have conversations offline that will help you with that as well.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please proceed.
I will talk about Grant Dewey for a while. He is nationally recognized. He has published, unfortunately, the tragedy with some of our mass killings, he has become and has written a book on mass murder, so he is recognized around the country as an expert researcher, and he's going to introduce you to some of our projects.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. This morning I'll talk about trends that we've seen over the last decade or so, trends as to what's happening now with Minnesota prisoners, as well as what we anticipate taking place in the future. But then I'll also briefly share some major findings from research studies that we've done in addition to program evaluations. And I think it's important to emphasize that since the beginning of the 21st century, we've seen a little more than a 50% increase in the state's prison population. We've gone from a little more than 6,000 offenders to currently about 9,500 offenders. So we've seen a substantial increase. Now, most of that increase, however, took place between 2000 and 2007. Just over that period of time, we saw an increase of a little more than 2,500 offenders. But over the last 5 years, we've seen a modest increase. We've seen growth taper off in the size of the prison population. And so that's why when we're looking at projecting the future prison population, we see an increase of about 1,500. If current laws, policies, and practices remain the same over the next 10 years, we anticipate that the prison population would go up by about 1,500. And we see that in this graph here, that in 2000, we started off at 6,276. As of July of this year, or actually July of 2012, we were at 9,501. And then at the end of 2022, we anticipate that we'll be close to 11,000.
How do you make those assumptions,
Mr. Chair? Which
the assumptions about increased, is that based on increased population? What's the assumptions on? Cause it seems to me when we've had these budget reviews in the past or reviews by the department that there's always a projection that the bed impact's going to increase, that we'll have a greater need. Where do those assumptions come from when it seems like there's a decline in crime statistics?
Mr. Chair, the projections that we come up with over a 10-year period, it's based on a collaborative process with Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and we use a micro simulation model to forecast the prison population. But as far as assumptions are concerned, we look historically at admission trends within Minnesota's prison population. Then we also base our projections off of actual data that we have. And earlier, Commissioner Roy talked about fielding several inquiries from Wisconsin. We've also fielded inquiries from Wisconsin about the accuracy of our prison population projections, which over the last 6 years, the average error rate has been 0.1%. So we have actually developed a process that is highly accurate, which is not necessarily the case with Wisconsin, which is why they've asked us for some assistance in trying to help them figure out their forecasting process.
Very good. Continue.
So when we look at the sharp prison population growth from 2000 to 2007, most of that was driven by increases that we saw in methamphetamine offenses. In 2000, we had less than 100 offenders in prison for methamphetamine offenses. By 2007, that had grown to 967. And actually, that was not the high point, which was in 2006, which was about 1,100. So that is a sizable increase for one particular type of offense. But the other area where we did see an increase had to do with felony DWI offenders. The felony DWI law was enacted in 2002, so as of July 1st, 2002, we did not have any offenders in prison for felony DWI, whereas in 2007, we had 624. Now, that number of DWI offenders has essentially plateaued over the last 5 years. For example, on July 1st, 2012, we had a little more than 680 felony DWI offenders in prison. Now, over the last 5 years, as I mentioned, we have observed more modest population growth. Most of the offenses that we see have held steady. Now, we have seen a decrease in offenders coming into prison for drug offenses. On July 1st, 2007, it was a little more than 1,800. Actually, it was 1,887. And then as of July 1st, 2012, it was 1,646. Most of that is due to the decrease that we've seen in offenders coming into prison for methamphetamine offenses. The meth boom, as it were, has subsided. But we have seen several types of offenses where there are increases. Most notably, we have seen about a fourfold increase in offenders coming into prison for violations of orders for protection, stalking, and harassment. 5 years ago, we had less than 100 offenders who were in prison for those offenses, whereas July 1st, 2012, it was about 325. Now, the other area has to do with failure to register as a predatory offender. 5 years ago, we had a little more than 100 offenders incarcerated for that offense. We've seen an 85% increase in the number of offenders incarcerated for failure to register. So those are the two main types of offenses where we've seen an increase over the last 5 years.
Who's that, Sean?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Dewey, when you talk about those offenses and especially the methamphetamine, I think the DWI and the predatory offender registration violations can be very specific. Those methamphetamine cases or numbers related to drugs, it kind of goes back to my other question about the statistics. Is that the only offense, or are they incarcerated because of multiple offenses and that's tagged in that category without, you know, what I'm getting at is how many other offenses are they there for as well, along with the methamphetamine? It's not typically just the methamphetamine, unless it was a manufacturing case or...
Dr. Dewey.
Mr. Chair and Representative, with the methamphetamine offenses, that is their governing offense. That is the offense on which their release date is based, and it's typically the most serious offense that they do have, or the most serious sentence for which they're incarcerated. We do track how many active sentences that offenders do have. We haven't looked specifically yet at the methamphetamine offender population to determine how many have multiple active sentences, but that is something that we can look at.
Thank you.
Dr. Dewey and Commissioner, you know, we can... We'll go to the end of our committee time, but we can have you back, too. I'd rather you spend the time on your slides and do this the way you wanted to rather than rushing through.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing that's important to emphasize when offenders come into prison is that they're often undereducated. They typically lack vocational skills, a legitimate work history, often have lengthy histories of substance abuse, and they're more likely to be mentally ill. But then when offenders leave prison and go back to the communities from which they came, due to the stigmatizing mark of a criminal record, it's more difficult for them to obtain housing, to find employment. So there are a number of challenges that offenders have in embracing a law-abiding lifestyle, but these deficits that offenders have, these areas of challenge, if you will, these are the areas that we try to target in terms of programming. And in an effort to determine what programming the DOC provides is effective in reducing recidivism, we've undertaken a fairly aggressive research agenda over the last 5 to 6 years. This slide lists some of the research studies and program evaluations that we've completed over the last 5 to 6 years, and most of these have been published in peer-reviewed academic journals to ensure that the research work that we do is of the highest quality. But the findings from these studies also help us to identify programs that either are effective, or maybe there are ways to make a program more effective, or maybe a program isn't that effective in reducing recidivism. If that's the case, then we need to know that in order to either find another program that works or to make improvements to that program so that it can become effective. And what we have found is that sex offender treatment delivered in prison, that it reduces sexual recidivism by 27%. Chemical dependency treatment delivered in prison reduces rearrest by 17%. And then Minnesota Circles of Support and Accountability, this is a reentry program for high-risk sex offenders. We recently completed an evaluation of that. We found that it reduces rearrest for a new crime by 62%. We also did a cost-benefit analysis for this program and found that for every dollar that we spent on MnCOSA, that it's produced a benefit of $1.82 to the state.
And can I just ask you how many, if you know off the top of your head, how many sex offenders who are released are not getting treatment from the Department of Corrections?
Mr. Chair, I don't have the exact number for you, but the vast majority of sex offenders who come into our prison system do not receive treatment or sex offender treatment while they're incarcerated.
Okay. So maybe that's for a later date. You can bring that research also, and also for chemical dependency. Would that also be the case?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was going to be my suggestion, if we could get the numbers of folks that are not getting chemical dependency treatment as well, so we can get a full picture of.
So I think we're going to have a special day on treatment, so that'll be important. Please continue.
We've also found that offenders who obtain a post-secondary degree while they're incarcerated, it reduces risk of rearrest by 14%. MnCorps has an employee program, which is a reentry employment program for offenders. We found that it reduces the risk of rearrest by 35%. And then we've also recently evaluated the Interchange Freedom Initiative, or IFI, which is a faith-based program run by Prison Fellowship. We found that it reduces rearrest by 26%. One of the nice things about IFI is that it exacts no additional cost to the state, but it does produce a recidivism reduction. So from a cost-benefit perspective, there are a lot of advantages to that. And then finally, we've evaluated the Challenge Incarceration Program, which is the state's correctional boot camp, and we found that it reduced rearrest by 32%. We also did a cost-benefit analysis for that program and found a cost avoidance of $6 million for the first 10 years that program was operating.
Mr. Chair.
I knew that was coming. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And are you looking at expanding that program?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom. The burden of expanding that program falls on all of our shoulders in this room today. We would love to expand because we recognize the good work that's being done there. And all programs come with costs, and we will detail those costs during our budget hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, that concludes my portion of the presentation.
Thank you. I look forward to having you back here to discuss these treatment programs in more detail so we can really get a sense of what you're doing and how and the progress that you're making. Representative Kelly had a question. Dr. Dewey, maybe you want to wait 1 minute.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Dr. Dewey, I just want to go back to that forecasting question just a little bit. And I think you referred back to 6 years ago, and then the accuracy rate, I think you said by 0.1%. So just confirming that, is this is a new research-based model then from that time period going forward that has that accuracy? I would assume we're suggesting going forward that's what we're basing this on, because prior to that we really didn't have a decent way of forecasting it.
Dr. Dewey.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we've actually used the same micro simulation model since the early 1980s, since we started using the sentencing guidelines system. There have been some major updates or revisions to that model. I can't really speak to the accuracy of our forecasts prior to 6 years ago, because that preceded my direct involvement in the forecasting process. But what I can say is that over the last 6 years, since I've assumed main responsibility for the forecasts, or at least generating the forecasts, that's what we've seen in terms of the accuracy from the our actual prison population versus what we projected to be.
Okay. Thank you.
So Kelly, it's, you know, we should probably have a broader discussion of that too at some point, because in Representative Hillstrom's committee yesterday, if I understood the charts when they were doing the overview, it seemed like the number of juvenile cases was really declining over the last 10 years. And I would assume that's a precursor for individuals going into our adult system. So if that's declining, then how does that correlate with the assessments that we're going to have increased adults in our population? So it's probably too detailed to get into at this point. So I am going to butcher your name, and I don't want to do that.
It's Uglum.
Uglum.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Representative Uglum.
Mr. Chair, question. On all of these research results and things, with these percentages you're showing us and everything else, are you benchmarking this from year to year and also comparing this with similar programs in other states? And also, do you conduct cost-benefit analysis on every one of these programs?
Dr. Dewey.
Mr. Chair and Representative, to take your last question first, we have not conducted cost-benefit analyses on every program evaluation that we've done, but we do hope to achieve that in the future so that we can look at all the programs that we operate, or at least the main ones, and have some idea of the cost-benefit for a particular program. For example, every dollar that we spend on CD treatment, here's the benefit that we see. We think that will be helpful not only for our purposes, but also for yours. And then to address the other question that you had, generally speaking, when we are evaluating a program, we either do a retrospective evaluation where we look back in time, and we will use matching procedures to put together a comparison group that is very similar to our treatment group. But then for prospective evaluations, we will, if possible, use randomized assignment, which is typically regarded as the most rigorous type of research design possible. Like with the MnCOSA evaluation that I mentioned earlier, we used a random assignment for that.
Representative Hoogland.
And follow up, Mr. Chair. Comparisons to other states on these programs?
Dr. Dewey?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the unfortunate reality is that there aren't a lot of states that evaluate their programs or conduct research to the scale that we do. We can only make comparisons with research that's been published. And unfortunately, there isn't a lot of published research for all of the programs that we have evaluated. Although, I mean, for sex offender treatment, for example, there are other evaluations that have been done, or even for chemical dependency treatment. And we try to make those comparisons when possible, and we'll review that in the course of the literature review that we do for each program evaluation.
Yeah. Thank you. Please proceed. We have about 10 minutes left. And Commissioner, again, you know, if the folks that you brought to testify, if we can't get them all in today, we'll do it at our next time with DOC.
Mr. Chair, we appreciate that accommodation. Mr. Chair, sitting next to me is Carrie Gerlicher. She's the director of our Special Investigations Unit. She is the cop of our department, and wears that title proudly.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Carrie Gerlicher, and I am the director of the Office of Special Investigations and the chief law enforcement officer for the Department of Corrections. Some of you may have remembered that in the year 2000, the legislature created a Department of Corrections and put it within the Department of Corrections to help us deal with our own internal criminal investigations and fugitive apprehensions in the community. This is my 28th year in public safety work. I started when I was four. I've worked as a juvenile probation officer in Hennepin County and dealt with a concentration of serious juvenile offenders with serious gang ties. I then went to Minneapolis Police Department, and the chief of Crosby, Chief Coughlin, and I were partners back in the day. So when you see Kim, tell her that I said hello, please. Within the Minnesota Department of Corrections, we take public safety and officer and staff safety very seriously. We also incorporate ourselves into many committees that do work, public safety work, all over the state. I currently sit on the Violent Crime Commission. One of my staff sits on the Forensic Lab Advisory Committee. I'm a member of the Minnesota Chiefs. We participate in several levels with the Minnesota Joint Analysis Center. We also sit at the table for the ARMOR statewide radio program. The Office of Special Investigations contributes daily to vetting information out to local law enforcement units. There is a wealth of intelligence information through phone calls, letters, and those sorts of things between offenders and people in the community. The offenders know, even though all of our telephones are clearly placarded in multiple languages, that the phone calls are recorded and can be listened to, that we only have the ability to listen to about 3% of those phone calls. So they still have the the wherewithal to speak very freely on those phones. And because of the work that my investigators do, working those phones and other things, we're able to proactively not only work our own cases, but do a tremendous amount of work for outside law enforcement. Recent federal cases with Native Mob, one of my investigators was the head investigator on that case. We were very critical in Hennepin County's recent 19 Dipsets gang case. And we have those types of cases that we are working on a constant basis with outside law enforcement. Felony level assaults on staff within our corrections. Our agency takes staff security and safety very seriously. In order for a staff assault to become a felony level, it has to meet a couple different state statutory obligations. First of all, the harm caused has to be demonstrable. So being punched in the face is not enough. You have to have a bruise when you wake up in the morning. Being kicked in the back is not enough. You have to have a marked footprint that I can photograph. Otherwise, it doesn't meet state standard. Other things that make assault felony levels for staff is when they get urine and feces thrown on them, which happens on, unfortunately, a somewhat regular basis, and when they get spit on. So not necessarily a great safe place for staff to work on a daily basis, but luckily we are housed and employed by many, many very professional staff. They know how to work in these situations, and they know how to deal with offenders. But our staff uniform ratio to offenders is very important to keep those staff safe as well as keeping the offenders safe in general. We have investigators, 2 to 3 housed inside each institution. I have an investigator that does all of our own criminal case investigations. Those cases are referred directly to the prosecutor's office in the counties in which we have institutions. And I'm happy to say that those relationships with our prosecuting attorney's offices are extremely strong. They take our cases very seriously, as do we. There was a time several years ago when we had judges and even some attorneys that said, you know, you've got an offender that's going to do 25 years. What's the use of us continuing to prosecute them as they assault staff? Well, first of all, to the morale of the staff to have that case ignored is tremendously difficult. It's very important that they're acknowledged that they were injured in the line of duty. But it also has an effect on other offenders when they see that we take those cases seriously and they prosecute those cases. It does cut down in cases in the future. We also are constantly looking for other ways proactively to reduce our assaults. Deputy Commissioner Carlson will shortly talk about a conflict management program that we are working on with staff and offenders. We have highly trained tactical teams and crisis negotiation teams in each agency, and those teams are also available to outside law enforcement should they need them. Fugitive unit, we work on state fugitive apprehension around the state. We have 8 of us that are sworn officers that work the street. We work cooperatively with your local law enforcement agencies every single day. State statutory language requires that when we come into your community and work, that we have to notify your dispatchers so no, we're not coming in covertly and doing stuff and then leaving without telling your locals. I would say probably 98% of our arrests are made in conjunction with your local officers. If an arrest took place without your local officer, the only reason would be because it went down so fast that your cops didn't have a chance to get there in time. But I guarantee that they were there before we left. We have ongoing relationships with Ramsey County. They have a full-time officer that works with us. We also have an ongoing relationship with the Minneapolis Police Department. They send an officer to us 3 times a year for a 4-month stay. It's a career enrichment for them. And it's no secret that, and I'm sure Representative Mullery will say this many times, many of our offenders are in his community. And so having us have a Minneapolis officer work with us on a regular basis allows them to go back to their agency and continue to network with us when they're back on the street. 2 of my officers are embedded with the U.S. Marshals, so we do cooperative work with the U.S. Marshals all the time. We do statewide fugitive sweeps in your jurisdictions throughout the state, and we also do a lot of work with tribal law enforcement officers.
Director Gerlich. It's Gerlicher?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Did I pronounce it right?
Okay. That's correct.
Representative Simon had a question for you.
Just a quick question. Could you just tell us what your definition of fugitive is in this context?
So the
Director Gerlicher.
Mr. Chair, the fugitive unit has statewide jurisdictions to arrest any Department of Corrections releasee who's on some sort of fugitive warrant. Our partnership with the U.S. Marshals does allow those 2 officers to also participate in all U.S. Marshals warrants, both in and out state.
Director Gerlacher, maybe we'll just finish your presentation, or how much more time do you have?
Maybe 3 or 4 minutes.
Okay, perfect. And then we'll adjourn for the day, and we'll have the rest of your witnesses come at the next meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The two areas of arrest that the fugitive unit concentrates on, though we arrest everyone, we really concentrate on offenders who have a history of loss of life. Could be anything from a DWI fatality to a first-degree murder conviction. Obviously, those with murder one and two, we spend more of our resources on. And also level three sex offender. The goal is to bring loss of life and level three sex offenders back into custody within 72 hours. We have a 98% rate of arrest with level three sex offenders. In this past year, a 65% arrest rate with loss of life offenders. We currently also have a hot file creation for level three sex offenders. So before the offenders even hit the street, I have two analysts and an investigator that meet with these offenders. They get a real in-depth connection to their past, to their community, and who they're going to be spending time with, so that when the level three sex offender goes on warrant status, we already have a file of intelligence to go on. We're not creating that at 2 in the morning. And we do have a 24-hour response time, so if an agent puts a warrant out for a level three sex offender or a loss of life offender on a Sunday at 2 a.m., we're up and we're moving by 2:15. We 24 hours a day, we're working on these offenders. We have been a participant in the Director, Armor Project.
Director, can I have a question here first? Well, first I'd like to know, do all State Department of Corrections have fugitive apprehension units?
Mr. Chair, a good question. When we went to the legislature in 2000 to have this law enforcement unit, that was some of the research that we were done, and at that time over 55% of states had. And I know the number has increased over time. As I continue to go to meetings around the country, I know that those numbers have increased.
Okay, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are you also activated when a juvenile escapes or something like that?
Director Gerlacher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, we are activated. In fact, we had two juveniles that walked away from Red Wing recently, and we had a cooperative working relationship that night. We sent four of my fugitive investigators to Red Wing. We worked with Goodhue County and the community for about 36 hours straight, and the juveniles are apprehended in the community, buried in the railroad tracks. So we work on those apprehensions very closely, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed.
And Mr. Chair, we are participating in Armor. Shortly after 9/11, the federal government put narrow-banding interoperable radio policy in place around the country. All law enforcement was obligated to be NIMS compliant by the end of calendar year 2012, and the Department of Corrections did meet that federal mandate. We participated heavily in two events in the past, the 35W bridge collapse and the RNC, where we had officers on the street working with local law enforcement agencies, and we were really limited in the amount of assistance we could give because at that point in time our radio systems were not compliant, not only within each other. I didn't have Stillwater Prison couldn't talk to Oak Park Heights Prison on a radio because they had different radio systems. We also weren't capable of talking to outside law enforcement. With the application of the Armor system, we now are able to talk with law enforcement all around us, and we are also able to talk with each other on a daily basis, and we've had to use that interoperability several times already this calendar year. We also, in our NIMS compliancy, have a chair at the State Emergency Operations Center. We are part of the governor's SEOC. It allows us to respond to emergencies at a statewide level much more frequently and much more quickly. We were able to respond to the recent floods in northeast Minnesota very quickly. Not only did we have an institution in Moose Lake that was affected, but we also had trained emergency managers that were able to go to the city of Moose Lake and help them with their emergency management. We train with the locals in our community all the time and are seen as a great resource. We have three of us that are currently going through state emergency management certification. I have two classes left, as does two of the other managers in our agency.
Very good.
And the last slide, and I'm done. Is the Prison Rape Elimination Act is a new unfunded federal mandate that took place in mid-2012. all departments of corrections need to be compliant by August of 2013, and the Prison Rape Elimination Act is guidelines and doing exactly what the title says, attempting to eliminate sexual assault in prison. It deals with sexual assault and harassment. It is an agency-wide initiative. It involves investigation. It involves behavioral health modification. It involves cooperative efforts with victim services, a holistic approach to trying to wrap our hands around not only offenders and offenders having aggressive sexual assault, but also our staff having sexual relationships with offenders, which is a felony by state law.
Very good. Thank you for your presentation.
That is the end of my fun presentation, Mr. Chair.
Any quick questions, Representative Kelly?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Regarding this mandate, then, did it come with guidelines, penalties? What's in store for us in the future, then, if we're not in compliance?
Director Gerlacher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelly, it came with a whole lot of mandates. It came with a 286-page booklet, of which about a half are mandates. Very limited federal funding. The federal funding really only has applied to training through the Prison Rape Elimination Network out of D.C. And if we are not compliant, audits will start next year. If this agency is not compliant, we will lose a third, I believe, of all federal funding to the Department of Corrections. Not only that, but it also is going to put us in a place where civilly the costs for us are going to increase. It's the right thing to do. I'm proud to say that this state has been way above the curve, way ahead of the curve from other states across the country in our dealings. We've always dealt with prison rape very seriously. So though we do have some work to do, we are not nearly in the place where a lot of other states are.
Thank you.
Okay, we're out of time. Director Gerlacher, Dr. Dewey, Commissioner, thank you very much. This meeting's adjourned.